And the best thing we can do for the longevity of these products is to make sure we use them only when it's really necessary to use it.
That's Dr. Michael Apley referring to the use of antibiotics in our livestock. He's my guest today as we not only talk through the history of antibiotics in our food animals, but also their purpose in today's cattle industry, both from an animal efficiency point of view, but also from an animal welfare perspective. Then we'll discuss implants being used and the narratives in our industry by both producers and consumers that tend to create division.
Casting aspersions on animals that have been produced using safe and effective implant technology is not appropriate either.
And then our last conversation will be as we talk about the use and the value of ionophores and beta agonists in our livestock feed. Today, join us as we talk about antibiotics, implants, and feed supplements in our cattle industry. That's on today's episode of the Working Ranch Radio Show. Hi, everyone. This is the Working Ranch Radio Show. I'm Justin Mills, your host, and thanks for joining us on our program. As you heard there in the opening, we are diving into a pretty deep topic here today as we look at the use of antibiotics and implants and feed supplements in our livestock industry. It's a topic that it's going to get kind of detailed, but at the same time, a lot of powerful information in that and also useful information when you get into the point where you may have to have an educated discussion with somebody about the products that we use in our industry. So we'll get into that in just a moment. I'll introduce our guest. Just a reminder as well that meteorologist Don Day will be on later in the show as we get a look at our long-term weather. And of course, the captain, Tim O'Byrne, publisher of Working Ranch Magazine, will be in for this week's edition of Tim's Two Cents. But joining us here today as our guest is Dr. Michael Apley, DVM. He is the Frick Professorship in the College of Veterinary Medicine at Kansas State University. And Dr. Apley, thanks for joining us here today on the Working Ranch Radio Show.
Thank you.
Well, as you and I talked before we went on air, I reached out to you. I had an agenda of a presentation that you did down at the Houston Livestock Show, and it was entitled Status of Using Antibiotics, Growth Promotants, and Feed Supplements to Improve Livestock Efficiency. And I thought, wow, we're hitting a lot of different topics there that I think would be very relevant to ranchers to just listen in on and hear some of that information that was in that presentation. And as we talk about that specifically, as we were talking a bit before we went on air, one of the things that you definitely specialize in your teaching at Kansas State is beef production medicine, pharmacology, and then food animal medicine. So there's a lot of things that are in that, especially in today's day and age where we just need to understand it better, I guess, is really, and that's why I wanted to have you on this. Let's start first of all with antibiotics. And as we were talking before we went on air, you said, you know, it's really interesting the history to go back and look at the history of antibiotics in our culture, in our society, and then its use later on in food animals. Explain what you meant by that.
Well, one of the examples I use with our students is my mom's still with us, and she was born in 1935. So when I go home and give mom a hug, I hug the real history of antibiotics in our society. And we got the sulfas in 1935. And, you know, we all know that Alexander Fleming kind of stumbled onto penicillin in 1928, but we really didn't get the penicillins used until about 1942 when we got mass production of them at the start of World War II. So our societal and species experience with antibiotic use has really been a lifespan. Mm-hmm. We all have people in our lives that are the lifespan of antibiotics. And if you go back and look at the approval of antibiotics, there was really kind of a golden age when we were discovering new groups right and left. And that went from the very early 40s. We got the tetracyclines in the late 40s. But it went from the early 40s to the early 60s when we got a whole bunch of our groups, and we've had some more since then. But the last time we got a new antibiotic group released, and this was in human medicine, but we now use some of them in veterinary medicine and in food animals, was the fluoroquinolones, and that was 1978. That was the last time we got a new group. And everyone listening will remember when we got some new antibiotics for like respiratory disease in cattle, you know, in the early 2000s and into the early teens. Yes, we did. but they weren't new or novel groups. They were new members of existing groups. And those are important. Those are important advancements, but they're not a new group. So we went through this age of, oh, we always had a new antibiotic to address anything that was resistant or not working. And we're well past that now, especially for food animals.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of food animals, when did we really start to see that use pick up and that evolution of the utilization of antibiotics in our food animals?
My dad, who was also a veterinarian, remembers growing up in Washington, Kansas, northeast Kansas. And as a child in the early 50s, they got their first bottle of penicillin that they got from a local pharmacy. And he talks about using it on calves that were sick and, you know, how miraculous it was. In 1949, there was an advertisement at Wallace's Farmer about oreomycin ointment for udder infections, and that's a tetracycline. And then there was one in 1950 for Gooch's Best Pig and Sour Meal with oreomycin in it. And that was when they were discovering that adding antibiotics to feed not only helped with health, but also improved performance, feed conversion, and rate of growth. And so that was part of that was actually because they started to develop more and more tetracyclines. And they said, oh, we need to find a place for these to go. And we're saturating the human market. And then they looked to veterinary medicine and the animals. And, you know, in the Washington Post in 1953 had a quote, "The antibiotics are becoming wonder drugs to save food crops. Give us more and tastier meats, even aid in making beer and whiskey." So they were being, it seems like everywhere you look, there was a place that they aided in some shape or fashion. And the advertisements continued with, you know, really, really being clear that these were part of our production. And then we started to get some reports, which people raising concerns that perhaps by using them too broadly in both human and animal applications, that we might cause ourselves some problems in the nature of resistance. And the first report that really summed up those concerns, and it was a consensus review, a literature review, and a consensus document, was the Swan Report, S-W-A-N-N, out of 1969, named after the gentleman who headed up the group. And it's basically a pamphlet that says, hey, you know, in animal husbandry and veterinary medicine, we should watch our use, just as we need to in human medicine. You know, and we had other reports like the O'Neill report out of the UK in 2015. We had the World Health Organization come out with a report in 2017 where they proposed some steps guiding use of medically important antimicrobials, antibiotics, and pre-producing animals. And they had three major suggestions or recommendations. And all of them were strong recommendations, but they acknowledged they had low quality evidence to cite that these needed to be done. One was an overall reduction in use of all classes of medically important antimicrobials in food-producing animals. So in other words, really watching how we're using them. And we use the term medically important there. And medically important means an antimicrobial antibiotic or an antibiotic group that's also used in human. Second recommendation was complete restriction of use of all classes of medically important antimicrobials in food-producing animals for growth promotion, strictly for enhancing rate of gain, feed conversion. And number three is recommending complete restriction of all classes of medically important antimicrobials, basically for prevention. So there's four ways we use antibiotics, and one is for treatment of ill animals. You have a cow with foot rot or a small steer with pneumonia, we diagnosed them as having that, we treat them. Another one is prevention, and that's defined as using antibiotics in a group when we have not noted a case yet, but we anticipate it's coming. Control is when we have diagnosed cases and are now going to treat everyone to attempt to reduce the spread. And the other one is strictly for the purpose of improving rate of gain or feed conversion, so growth promotion. When we start looking at the importance of antibiotics, the World Health Organization has updated their list several times. I think the last really current one was 2018 when they did a report, but it's their critically important antimicrobials in human medicine. And they have five groups that are the highest priority of their critically important. So they have three classes of importance, the highest one, which is critically, and then there's the highest priority. And cephalosporins, the third, fourth, and fifth generation. So anyone who's taken Keflex or any, you know, the human cephalosporins that is in there. The macrolides, which we use extensively in food animal medicine. So many of the antibiotics, four of the antibiotics labeled for treatment of respiratory disease in cattle are macrolides. So it's a very common class for us. And then the fluoroquinolones, which we use. We have two fluoroquinolones labeled for treatment of respiratory disease in cattle. Mm-hmm. So we have quite a little bit of overlap there in the antibiotics we use in veterinary medicine, food animal production for treatment, and some of those for control, and then also in human medicine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, and I know we'll, as we go through this, we'll get into some more of the dicier issues regarding this, because I think as we hear this and as you're giving us the history of this, we're going to be talking in our next segment about current uses around the world in the United States that we're seeing that. And as we talk about this, that we're drawing all this together, because at the end of this, we're going to pull this all together. And I want us to also visit a little bit its importance to our industry, and as well as the balance that we need in our industry with it as well. That's all the stuff we're going to talk about. My guest today is Dr. Apley. He's with, he's a Frick Professorship in Clinical Science at Kansas State University in their College of Veterinary Medicine. We'll continue with Dr. Apley after this break. Our segment today brought to you by Inherent Select from Zoetis. Don't miss your chance to save on genetic testing. Unlocking genetic potential starts with a complete picture of your commercial cow herd. You can learn how to get started with Inherent Select at beefgenetics.com/radio.
What if your commercial beef herd could be better than you thought possible? Genetic testing can help give you more confidence about what your herd is made of, and more importantly, what it can be. Inherent Select from Zoetis provides data-driven genetic insights to help you make more informed selection, breeding, and culling decisions about your cows and heifers. The journey from genetic potential to reality begins with Inherent Select. Ask a genetics rep how to save on testing with our whole herd promotion. Go to beefgenetics.com/radio.
Welcome back to the Working Ranch Radio Show. My guest today is Dr. Michael Apley with Kansas State University. He is the Frick Professorship in Clinical Science at their College of Veterinary Medicine. And we are hinging our discussion here today off of a presentation that he recently gave at the Houston Livestock Show on the status of using antibiotics, growth promotants, and feed supplements to improve livestock efficiency. And I know as we talk about that specific title, as I said in the intro of the last segment, probably a lot of things that kind of perks your ears up a little bit, especially in today's day and age with where the consumer is wanting and what we think that they're wanting, and trying to understand how do we utilize the medicine in our industry in a proper way, in a balanced way. But at the same time, it is important. We're going to talk about that later on as well. We've already talked a little bit about the history of antibiotics, both not only in our human culture, but also from a food animal use as well. And let's go now, Dr. Apley, let's talk a little bit more about what we're seeing today, current uses around the world, its application that we're seeing around the world and here in the U.S. as well.
Well, and it's important to start out with talking about, well, why is there the concern? You know, why are we looking at our antibiotic use so hard? Mm-hmm. And it's resistance.
Yeah.
In human medicine, we have organisms that we have only a few antibiotics that are able to treat it anymore. And sometimes, unfortunately, none. Those are rare cases, but they do happen. And the CDC's report gives, you know, an estimate of the number of cases each year that people die from resistant infections. And resistance doesn't necessarily mean there's nothing to treat the infection, although sometimes it can. A lot of times it means we're later in getting to an effective antibiotic because our typical antibiotic we use at the start isn't effective. And because of those concerns, the international community has addressed it, including the United States. And the OIE, mm-hmm. which is the World Organization for Animal Health, they used to be the OIE, now they're a different name, but they put out a report in response to the report we talked about a little bit ago in talking about the important antimicrobial agents for veterinary use besides just the human use. And one of the things they did was they put together a list of antimicrobial agents used for growth promotion in animals in 30 countries. They had 30 countries that responded to this. But the growth promotion has gotten a real front runner attention status. It's starting in January 1 of 2017, corresponding when producers will remember that they had to start getting a veterinary feed directive from their veterinarian for use of drugs in the mineral or in the feed, medically important antibiotics. The use of medically important antimicrobials for growth promotion in the U.S. was prohibited. And the key word there, again, is medically important. So a drug such as the tetracyclines, which that group is also used in humans, that is not, hasn't been able to be used for any growth promotion application in the U.S. since 2017. We can still use drugs such as the ionophores, which we'll hopefully circle back to later a little bit, and a few others that are not medically important. So it really, in the span of about 20 years, it went from kind of a few countries to almost all of our major countries, you know, the U.S., Canada, EU would have those types of prohibitions. And so what came on then was, what's the consequence of that in both animal health and in production? And one of the things that was noted in Denmark in the pigs was that they prohibited the growth promotion use, and the use of antibiotics for therapeutic uses then came up. They were still using fewer antibiotics, but they were using more for therapeutic use and disease outbreaks. They have since reduced that. And anytime you have a country that's, you know, promoting their low use as a reason, you know, for their buying their pigs or whatever, there's always controversy around how the numbers were done, et cetera, and what all it means. But so there's now, you know, get close to 30 years of experience in a lot of countries without the growth promotion use of those. And right now, when you look at the next steps that's going on across the pond, if you would, from a 2020 publication, they are saying, here's where we think we're going. They hope to do a ban on preventive use, possibility to reserve certain antimicrobials for humans only. And there's a list over there, but it would reserve certain classes of antimicrobials and certain generations of some classes for human use only, and no use in any veterinary application, whether it's a dog, a cat, or a food animal. The list as it stands right now wouldn't really touch that many that we currently use in food animals in the United States. And of course, there's the controversy of the European Union saying to import your product, you have to produce it according to our standards, which is obviously quite controversial.
Yeah.
But so we've evolved to the place now where we are looking at how we monitor antibiotic use and get a picture of what's going on. And one of the things I sometimes get from producers is they're offended. Like, we're insinuating that they aren't taking good care of their stock, or they're not trying to use these antibiotics appropriately, you know, and that's not the intent at all. We recognize everyone's commitment to the health of their animals, but still, when we look at the overall resistance issue, we do need to preserve these valuable products that we haven't had for that long. And, you know, just treating a cow in one of your pastures up there for foot rot on a Tuesday morning, is that going to cause resistance in a hospital in New Jersey next week? Yeah, I'll have a hard time making that connection. Could widespread use of an antibiotic in food animals, perhaps select for a salmonella or an E. coli that could be passed to people or potentially through the food chain? When you start talking about through the food chain and the food chain we have here in the United States, that gets less and less of a possibility, but it's not zero. And even though a big driver of the conversation is the potential for our use in food animals to have an effect on the ability to treat disease in humans, still, we also have to say, what about our ability 30 years from now, 20 years from now, to treat our own diseases in food animals? And I'm not saying the sky's falling, but we do see some resistance in some of our pathogens. And resistance could be a whole nother radio show. Yeah. We could spend the whole time just talking about what resistance is, how we define it, how it travels, all those things. I had a friend explain to me that if you understand antibiotic resistance, it hasn't been adequately explained.
Pretty complicated.
Yeah, it is. And it's not saying people aren't smart enough to do it. It's just a lot of us study it all the time, and there's still a lot of we don't knows. And so it's a big old complicated issue. And where it comes down to is the benefit of use versus the risk of use, because antibiotics are one of the few drugs we use that by using it in a widespread manner, we can degrade the ability to use it later. And so that's the balance. You know, the balance word always comes into this conversation, right? And so now there's even concern about use of antifungals in agriculture. Could we, and we have some resistant fungi, you know, one of the top five resistant organisms, Candida auris, is a fungal organism in the humans that we're seeing significant resistance in. And, you know, that's not saying agriculture is doing it, but we're in on the conversation.
Yeah. Well, and there's a lot of things agriculture gets brought into the conversation, whether we're talking antibiotics, whether we're talking climate change, whether we're talking, as you were just mentioned there, on the antifungal and those conversations. So we really need to be aware of some of this, of those conversations that are going on. My guest today is Dr. Michael Apley with Kansas State University. We're going to continue on. Coming up after this break, we're going to get into talking about implants, and later on, we'll be talking about ionophores and beta agonists. We'll be back on the Working Ranch Radio Show after this.
Capitalize on crossbreeding with Gelb-V and Balancer bulls. Raise replacement females with added fertility, increased longevity, and greater productivity. Gelb-V and Balancer influenced females wean more pounds of calf per cow exposed. In the feed yard, Balancer influenced cattle offer increased performance, improved feed efficiency, and have excellent carcass merit. Balancers add the pounds, make the grade, and deliver the value. Make your crossbreeding count with Gelb-V and Balancer genetics.
Welcome back to the Working Ranch Radio Show. My guest today is Dr. Michael Apley. He is the Frick Professorship in Clinical Science at Kansas State University in their College of Veterinary Medicine. And Dr. Apley, as we were talking about in the last segment, more of what we're seeing with current uses around the world in the United States in antibiotics and off air, I was talking about the quote that you mentioned in the last segment of we're weighing out the benefit of use versus the risk of use. And I know in our society today, you talked about that in the last segment, there's always that conversation about balance. And then the other term, of course, resistance, as you said, is quite a complicated issue or a conversation just in itself of understanding that. And I mentioned to you that I think for a lot of us, yeah, we don't want to see overuse. We don't want to cause an issue in our industry. But I can tell you, if we don't have these antibiotics, our industry looks way different as well.
That's right. And so we did a study in feedlots, and it was not a statistical sample of the industry. And we repeated that work. We did 4 years worth and are on another project now. And this was a cooperative agreement with the FDA. But for example, in 2017, in the feed yards, we sampled, okay? Not a statistical sample of the industry. But we found by looking at milligrams of drug per kilogram of live weight sold, about 93% of the use was two drugs in the feed. And that was Tylosin for reduction of liver abscesses and chlortetracycline for treatment of respiratory disease. If you look at regimens per animal year, another way of looking at it, it was like 78%. Mm-hmm. There are two different metrics for looking at it. But it's the majority. And so sometimes we get really concerned because we think, well, we were talking about we got to stop treating ill animals. No, the actual acute treatment of an acutely ill animal, that it's got pneumonia, it's got foot rot, it's got pink eye. When you look at the overall use, it's really relatively small. Mm-hmm. And the larger use is for other purposes. The one is treatment of respiratory disease, but the other one is really it doesn't have prevention or control on the label, but it's reduction of liver abscesses. So those rightfully gain a lot of our attention. I've done a literature review looking at the effect of the macrolide, Tylosin, for reduction of liver abscesses. And you look at all the data, and it's pretty hard to find a really big clear signal that we are selecting for something that would cause an issue either in our cattle or in human. So whenever I hear generalities used to describe the risk of antibiotic use, I become very concerned because there's a lot of data there. And it's when we also look at our efficiency, our contributions to whatever, and our use of commodities, these have a real benefit for us. Mm-hmm. So that balance word is something that we need to continue to be part of the conversation. I know NCBA is, you know, there's a lot of producer groups that are part of this. Our American Association of Bovine Practitioners is very actively involved in a lot of these. The American Veterinary Medical Association is actively involved in them. You know, our next thing, since growth promotion is kind of past us now, is addressing prevention and control uses of antibiotics, where it won't really be addressed.
Well, and as I hear you talking about that, I guess the thing that come to my mind, and I think this is in one of the seven habits of highly effective people, if I'm not mistaken, is seek to understand is one of the points in that. And I, as you were talking about that, we can really get ourselves wrapped up in the complicity of everything. And it is there, as you said. I mean, we could put a show together on various, some of these different things that we've already talked about here today. But I think the worst thing that we can do is go down a certain road regarding this particular issue of antibiotic use in our industry and go down a certain road and say, well, this is where it needs to be, when really it's hard to understand this. And I think we just have to be open-minded with where this is going and understand not only, yeah, there's overuse, but yeah, we can't necessarily not, because there's some elements that it's providing in terms of efficiency to our industry that is pretty critical. Pretty important.
Well, and the ability to address health issues.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, and just like people, animals get sick. And then there's the argument of the production environment and its, you know, effect on that. But animals get sick just like people, and we want to be good stewards of the animals and take care of them. And there are what I think are bright spots. I just about a year ago came off of the Presidential Advisory Council on Combating Antibiotic-Resistant Bacteria. There were 15 voting members and 10 members representing different parts of, you know, different things that participated in conversations. And five of us from food, animal, and veterinary medicine, and 10 from human. And we did a lot of exploring things together. And it's, again, the Presidential Advisory Council on Combating Antibiotic-Resistant Bacteria, or PACCARB. And if you Google PACCARB, P-A-C-C-A-R-B, you can go to their website and look at a lot of the reports. You can actually go through the meeting agendas, and we have experts come in and testify. If you have an interest in antibiotic resistance, you should definitely tune in on PACCARB and see what they're doing in their meeting.
Okay. All right. We've got a little bit left time left in this segment. Let's talk about implants, because I know that's something that always comes up in the conversation as well.
Implants is short and sweet for me. They have been approved as safe and effective by a rigorous approval process through the FDA Center for Veterinary Medicine. We've been using it for years. The amount of any hormone added to the animal over their base amount is minuscule. That's why they've been approved as safe and effective. They have been prohibited in other parts of the world. And we won a suit with the World Trade Organization about that they are in fact safe and effective. I remain convinced of that. And they do great things for us in allowing us to produce beef efficiently. Mm-hmm. You know, and then we have issues sometimes in exports for like zearalenone, which you'll know as trade name Ralgro. That can actually be produced naturally by some Fusarium species in feed. The animal could absorb that and through metabolism actually have very trace amounts of that hormone in them from a natural source. So we always have to deal with that if it's detected. And that's one of the things today also, is that our ability to detect these different chemicals every 3 to 4 years goes down by a factor of 10. You know, when I was doing my PhD back in, well, I hate to say this, but finished in 1992, I was playing around with a mass spec with fluorescence detection, and I could get down to the low parts per million. And the last study I did here, we were in the parts per trillion, easy, with a triple quad mass spec. And so we detect things now that we go, I wonder what the relevancy of that is. You know, we can detect, you know, a molecule in a swimming pool type stuff. But to me, I think all of the producers out there should be confident in that those are safe and that they... You know, if there's one thing we give it to shoot that I know is going to return for us, it's an implant. I'm not casting aspersions on people who choose to produce animals without that. That's fine. That's what we do in this country. People have choose their way of producing and choose their way of consuming, and that should be no other way. But I think casting aspersions on animals that have been produced using safe and effective implant technology is not appropriate either.
Yeah. And I agree with you there. I think, you know, I grow our calves and our cattle a certain way. And that's one of the things that I've always been frustrated with in our industry is when one way looks at the other way and says, well, our product is safer or better. And that's a little that's a little frustrating because we already are divided enough in our industry, whether it's on political issues or various trade issues or things within our industry, that when we start making even further divisions based upon claims like you're saying that maybe don't have the validity to them like they used to. And I might get some emails from this. I don't know regarding some of this, but I just don't like to see the divisiveness of saying, well, our product is safer than that product. I feel that's not in the best or best for our industry overall.
Yeah. And I fully support the choice but am always open to have a conversation about the actual implications of one way of production or the other. And sometimes it's a lifestyle choice, if you will. I don't choose for anything, quote, quote, not natural to be used in them. Fine. Good deal. Happy to make sure you have product for that. Mm-hmm. But let's just be straight up about the actual indications. And there's several reports, for example, saying that organically produced product is not safer or more nutritious than ones produced under other methods. Mm-hmm. You know, I just looked at one of those papers the other day. Again, those who wish to have naturally produced or organic, power to you. But I tell you, I hate to use the word conventionally, but in our freezer at home and for my family, there is beef that is produced using modern technologies, and I'm completely comfortable that it is safe and wholesome for my family. So,
yeah. I think too, as you said, I'm an absolute believer in choice in terms of how we want to raise them. And I think if you can get the money, the value out of the product you're selling, however you need to do it, figure it out. The best way to get the best return on your investment, if you can get paid for an all natural product, then absolutely, because there are buyers, there are people that want that, and that is just fine. At the other side of it, you just got to weigh that out. And I think that's the pencil needs to dictate a little bit of that and not maybe things that we factually can't really put into true facts. Let's take a break here. When we come back, we've got one more set of subject topics that we're going to visit with Dr. Apley about, and that is we'll get into talking about ionophores and beta agonists. We'll be back on the Working Ranch Radio Show after this. Welcome back to the Working Ranch Radio Show. Dr. Michael Apley, who is the Frick Professorship in Clinical Science at Kansas State University, in their College of Veterinary Medicine. We've had a lot of deep discussion here on the use of antibiotics and growth promotants in our industry. And boy, this is something I encourage you to go back and listen to the show again, because I know he shared with us some stuff that you're going to need to think through a little bit. You go to workingranchradioshow.com and you can download the show and replay that again. Okay, as we sort of wrap up our conversation here today, Dr. Apley, let's talk into the other area of use that we see, and it's pretty important, and this is the ionophores and beta agonists. Let's talk about that and its use and that element in our animal industry.
We have beta agonists that are approved for use in the United States. One is approved for cattle, swine, and turkeys, another in cattle. These have been approved, again, as safe and effective by the FDA Center for Veterinary Medicine. They're also approved as safe and effective in Brazil, Canada, South Korea, and Mexico. They are banned in China and the European Union. Some interesting things about internationally about them. And let's use ractopamine,
okay,
which is one that is approved here in the United States. So Codex Alimentarius, an international standards organization, has approved a maximum residue level, or an MRL. In the U.S., we call them tolerances. But it is essentially how much of the drug, or drug and metabolites, however it's done for the MRL, is how much of residues can be present. And you could consume that commodity with that amount of drug in it every day for your life and have a big safety factor of no adverse events. That's what that is. Okay. So an MRL was approved by Codex, yet zero tolerance is enforced by China, Taiwan. And it's an interesting situation, right? we have an international standards organization saying, hey, if you're below this much, you're golden. With an extensive safety factor, you could consume X amount of that product every day for your life with that much residue in it and be completely safe. And that's from extensive toxicology studies, et cetera. Yet we have countries that are enforcing a zero tolerance. And another thing that's really interesting when you start to get into exports with some of these drugs, where you have maybe a zero tolerance or a different MRO. And a zero tolerance means that if they detect any, that they consider that violative and they reject the product. And remember that we're now parts per trillion and well into the parts per trillion, way down there. But it's interesting that the method of analysis affects that too. And that's been a problem. There's a complicated part about the analysis for ractopamine that certain preparations of the material, whether it's muscle, liver, kidney, for analysis can actually increase the amount of parent compound. And if the parent compound sits somewhere before analysis, or the parent tissue, say it's muscle, sits somewhere and gets warm before it's tested, that can also increase the parent compound. So there's all these types of things. It's based on the analysis, but there's another drug class proven as safe and effective that can have benefits for us. You know, there, as for any drug, there's how we use them. There's stewardship that goes with that. But some places have used that as a trade barrier. Mm-hmm. And we've shown them safe and effective. And we have an international standards body and codex that has established that, yeah, below this MRL, things are good. So another one that is used quite extensively, and we alluded to it early in the show, was the Ionophore. Mm-hmm. And you may recognize those trade names such as Rumensin, Catalyst, Bobatec. And these drugs, they are a drug, and we call them an antibiotic in the United States because they are. Mm-hmm. And the definition of an antibiotic is a compound produced by one organism that inhibits the growth rate. So they are an antibiotic. And so if someone says antibiotic-free with no asterisks, they might take out the ionophores also, because in the U.S., we consider them an antibiotic, again, which they are. Mm-hmm. In Europe, they fixed it by just not calling them an antibiotic. They call them an anticoccidial. So, well, let's just change the name, fix that deal, right? But in the U.S., we're honest about what they are. But they are a non-medically important antibiotic, and I have yet to see any piece of data that would suggest that they select for any type of resistance that would have an issue in cattle, any animal, or people. So there's one that we call them an antibiotic, they are, but I just see no drawback at all of using it. They help control coccidia. They do a great job of controlling coccidia in cattle and in poultry. Mm-hmm. They help us improve efficiency and some of them rate of gain in cattle. So we have some technologies to me, beta agonists, ionophores, in our implants that to me are, there are benefits all the way around. They improve our efficiency. They help us with animal health. And I'm just looking for a safety concern from them when used properly. Mm-hmm. You know, our discussion of antibiotics would show that we, you know, the resistance thing, I don't pretend to understand it. I think if you were to say the resistance problem in humans is 3 foot tall, our contribution from food animals to that is definitely way down in the inches, way down in inches. That may be an overgeneralization or maybe links I don't understand. I don't think there's such a thing as completely isolated bacterial populations, but it all goes back to being smart for all these technologies, smart about our use, knowing how to use them appropriately, putting them in place at the appropriate time, appropriate dose. If there's withdrawal time, adhering to that, using them as they've been shown to be safe and effective, being actively engaged in the conversation about their use, how we use them safely and effectively. If you're a beef producer, you know, be BQA certified. Learn, go to meetings, learn about this stuff, read actively, and understand what you're using. Mm-hmm. And how you're using it. And being a veterinarian, I really urge you to have a veterinarian in your planning process, mm-hmm. Working with you as a producer. And I've got a lot of respect for producers. We do a hard job. Mm-hmm. We work hard. We take care of animals, and we produce wholesome food for our fellow people. And a lot of these technologies are a good part of that. And you know what's going to happen? We're going to continue to learn more about the place of each one and the risk versus the benefits. We're going to continue to learn more about that. And I look forward to us doing it. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Apley, we just got a short time here, but I want to ask you two questions and just and have you briefly give me your thoughts on these. And they're two questions. They're kind of similar in nature, but that's this. From your study and your research and the things that you have seen and know, we're going to start first with the consumer side of things. What is the biggest frustration that you have with the consumer and the perception that's out there with beef and antibiotics?
I think some of it is how we use them and the groups that are being used, the classes that are being used. You know, like fluoroquinolones and cephalosporins make up a very, very small part of what we use. And I think the reason for what we do, and I'm not going to paint us with a rose-colored brush, but by and large, we have a reason for what we're doing, and we're using ones in a manner for which they're intended to be used. And I think that's something to for people to understand, and that used appropriately, antibiotics have a real place in the welfare for the animals we produce. Again, as in any industry, we have room to grow and room to improve, but I think by and large, we make real efforts to be on top of how we're using them and use them to protect the welfare of the animals we raise.
You bet. Now, I'm going to ask the same question, but I'm going to now direct it to those of us, like myself, that are raising these animals, that are going to become the future dinner for somebody in a celebration festivity where they decide they want the best meal out there, so they order beef. And so for us as ranchers, from your perspective, some of your frustrations and or concerns regarding the antibiotic use and the, and this whole subject within our industry from a rancher side?
Well, I'd say not everyone who questions our practices wishes us ill. You know, I've worked with some really sharp people that have legitimate questions on why we do what we do and where this is and the implications of how we use them. I think that's it. It's not... You're either for us or against us, right? Mm-hmm. We can have these conversations. And again, back on packed carb, we had some great conversations about the uses, why we use them in both human and veterinary medicine. And we all have our problems and we all have our challenges with health. And I just encourage everyone to be real introspective on how we're using them ourselves. Ask lots of questions. And the best thing we can do for the longevity of these products is to make sure we use them only when it's really necessary to use them. And my goal is for us to have these valuable tools three generations from now, that we're still able to protect the welfare of our animals. When I see an animal walking by with foot rot or pneumonia, I'm able to do something about it that has a real effect. And again, not saying the sky's falling, but we have to be thoughtful and how we continue to use these valuable tools.
You bet. Well, we've dove deep on this subject, and I sure appreciate your conversation on this. Very, very informative. And I appreciate your final comments, because I think that's good, really, for a lot of us to not be so hard-jawed on a stance on some of this and realize that, you know, we need to think through this. And as you said, too, you know, make sure we're using these in the intended form that they're planned to use, because we do want them around for a long term. It is about the welfare of our animals. And we do want these products around for a long, long time. So, Dr. Apley, thanks for joining us here today on the Working Ranch Radio Show.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. And again, my guest today, Dr. Michael Apley with Kansas State University. A big discussion that I know for some, maybe it's a little bit overwhelming. And I know even for myself, some of the things we talked about here today, I'm not a cattle feeder myself. So I know there's some of the products that we talked about here today. It's not really something that I'm very familiar with in terms of a feeding standpoint. I understand their purpose, definitely. But at the same time, we're all in this. Whether we're the cow-calf producer, whether we're the feedlot operator, feedlot manager, the owner, whatever that is, we're all in this. And at the end of the day, we're all putting forth a product that is going to a consumer. And I think for all of us to have educated knowledge about these products that are in our industry. And one of the other and final things is, and we talked about that, I believe, in the segment where we were talking about implants, is to not be disparaging against one, how one person raises product versus the other. I think that is one of the things that could really be harmful when we start jumping in to some of the agendas that we see in society today and trying to use those agendas to sell a product and then be disparaging against other folks within our same industry. That's a concern to me. And I think our subject here today really was more about educating us on these uses, how they're used, why they're used. And again, at the end of the day, as he would said, we need to use them right. If we want to continue to have these in the long run, then we need to use them right as well. So a deep discussion here today, as I said before. And again, if you have any questions or comments about it, please feel free to send me an email at justin.workingranch@gmail.com. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, the Captain Tim O'Byrne will be in with this week's edition of Tim's Two Cents, and we'll hear from meteorologist Don Day with a look at our long-term weather. We'll be back after this.
Looking for the perfect gift for a gardener or weather enthusiast? Introducing the Tropo, a precision rain gauge that has revolutionized both reliability and convenience. Expertly engineered by meteorologists, the Tropo gauge boasts rugged durability, impeccable accuracy, and precision to the hundredth of an inch. Visit measurerain.com to order a Tropo today and use code RAINDAY, that's RAINDAY, for free shipping and 10% off. Go to MeasureRain.com.
Hey, Justin. Hey, everybody out there in Working Ranch Radio Land. The ranch horse market, I'm telling you what, they're selling hotter than a seized up swather bearing. And this next issue, our summer issue, Working Ranch Magazine, we will run once again the Equine Care Catalog. And just like the Cattle Care Catalog, it's set up to help folks just like you that have these amazing ranch horses, and you're taking care of them and putting lots of good products and nutrition into them. And go to the Equine Care Catalog in the summer issue, and you're going to see a whole list of products and companies that will be able to help you meet your ranch horse needs. And we love them and we need them. So take good care of them, folks. Back to you in the booth, Justin.
All right. Thanks, Captain. As you were talking about the summer edition coming out, boy, I'm still working my way through the April, May. And as you were talking horses, not only is there a lot of bull sales information in the April, May edition, there's also a lot of horse sale information in there as well. So check out your latest copy of Working Ranch Magazine. Well, as we turn now and take a look at our long-term weather, meteorologist Don Day is standing by. And Don, we were kind of talking before we went on air how I said, boy, I'm really not quite sure what to talk about when we start looking 7 to 10 days out, other than it's springtime of the year, and we just kind of have these waves of storms that move through.
Yeah, and that leads to a lot of, you know, variability in the weather, where you can have 3 or 4 days where you're thinking, well, spring is here, summer must be just around the corner. And then the next 3 or 4 days, it's cold and wet and temperatures drop off, and we have this weather pendulum that just goes back and forth. And it's April, and I call April the cruelest month of the year, because you can be basically in a summer pattern one day, winter the next. It's also the month that you really start to worry about more in the way of severe weather in parts of the country with severe thunderstorms and tornado activity. It's also the time of year where a lot of people are very susceptible, with, especially in the livestock industry, of these wild swings, you know, being a detriment.
Mm-hmm. When we look out about 5 to 7 days out, again, we have another storm pattern kind of moving through, as it's going to be sweeping up out of the southwest part of the country, moving to the north and the east. What kind of moisture are we talking through what parts of the country?
Well, I think a large part of the U.S. and a large part of Canada, with a couple of exceptions, have very good chances of picking up some more spring precipitation. And that really goes coast to coast, where we do see it a little bit drier and would like to see some better precipitation chances, would be that I-70 corridor across Kansas into Colorado, south into the Panhandles, into New Mexico. Those areas have been missing out on these storms. The storm track has definitely been more biased across the northern part of the U.S. Now, that hasn't been bad, because it has brought some areas places like Montana, northern Wyoming, the Dakotas that have needed some precipitation have gotten back into the act, but at the expense of areas a little bit further to the south. But if you were to look across the lower 48, I would say that other than that I-70 corridor area in the south central United States, the rest of the U.S. has got some good chances of precipitation, and in all forms, rain, thunder. I do see parts of the northern Rockies, northern plains having some snow chances mid to late next week, despite the fact that some of those areas will see 70 to near 80 degree temperatures.
Mm-hmm. Now, with this next one wave coming through, as you said, the higher elevations probably, you know, going to see some more of that moisture and snow. By and large, though, this next wave going through, is it mostly going to be rain on the lower areas, foothills down into the lower country?
It's looking like it. You know, one thing that we saw with the big storm that we had this past week was is that it didn't really have a Canadian connection. That kept snow levels fairly high. And that's typical as we get into mid to late April. You tend to have the rain and the thunderstorms on the plains, and you got to get it in that 5,000-6,000 foot elevation to where you have the more significant snows. I will say this, though, this upcoming week, this next storm has got a little bit more of a Canadian component. So some folks in the western U.S. could see well below average temperatures for a good 5 or 6 day period. On the flip side, out in the Midwest and areas in the east, a southerly wind flow will be pumping in some pretty warm air. So you're going to see the west cold, the east a lot warmer.
All right. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You bet. And again, that is meteorologist Don Day with a look at our long-term weather. By the way, maybe you've been looking or thinking about purchasing a digital weather station or rain gauge. If you check out his website at dayweather.com, he has some items on there that you might be interested in looking at for your operation. Stay with us. We're going to take a break here. We'll talk about what's in store for the upcoming edition of the Working Ranch Radio Show after this. I want to pass along a note I got from my friends at the American National Cattle Women's Organization. They're going to be having their Wired Conference coming up on June 7th and 8th this year, hosting it up in Columbus, Montana. So you can visit the Big Sky State there, and you're saying, well, why are we talking about it now? That's in June. Well, that's not that far off, and if you're going to be making plans to head that way for this conference, you probably need to get in planning for that. Their theme this year, Breaking Trail for Today's Cattle Women. They're going to have some great topics that are being up for discussion, talking on estate planning, water rights, vaccine, animal identification, shoot side manners. There will be some live cattle demonstrations and also a tour of the Midland Bull Test as well. So a great conference, the Wired Conference by the American National Cattle Women, coming up on June 7th and 8th in Columbus, Montana. You can register by going to their website at ancw.org/Wired. Well, coming up on next week's edition of the Working Ranch Radio Show, Trey Patterson with the Padlock Ranch. They're headquartered out of northern Wyoming. Also have places, land up into Montana, as well as Patrick Linnell with Cattle Facts will be joining us. We're going to be talking on some beef quality assurance topics, more specifically, a guide to cull cattle management and some of the topics inside of that particular conversation. So be sure to join us on next week's program. By the way, if you're listening here today, it's helpful if you can leave us a rating or review. We sure would appreciate that. Well, the Working Ranch Radio Show is a production of Working Ranch Magazine, branded number one by America's Ranchers. If you don't have a subscription, it's pretty easy to get started by going to workingranchmag.com. By the way, if you do want to get a hold of me, my email address is justin.workingranch@gmail.com. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Justin Mills, and until next time, keep your chin down and your mind in the middle. So long.